Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio. Welcome to The Blitz. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, coming to you from RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Please check out RenegadeTribune.com and go on over to HeathenHerbs.com for a lot of great products. Tonight, I want to talk about where we are headed, and that I will be doing so using a particular historical example, that of Cambodia under Pol Pot. But first, let us get some context here in the Western world for what's going on today. Let's take a look at an article that Sinead recently wrote. She has been writing some articles again for the Tribune, and that's good to see. And if you guys want to contribute your own thoughts, please do think about submitting some posts. I could always use some new creative content over there. This article is titled, Marxist-Leninist Party of Germany Unveils Lenin Statue, while Seattle's Lenin Statue Still Stands Tall. Yeah, you won't see these be getting defaced. They won't be torn down, have their heads removed, sawn off. Recently, the Marxist-Leninist Party of Germany unveiled a statue of Lenin in the city of Gelsenkirchen, Germany, after much objection from residents. City authorities even launched their own hashtag No Place for Lenin. However, the courts blocked their appeals. Wikipedia states the party's ideologies as the following: communism, Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, and anti-revisionist. That's right, they are openly against historical revisionism, since the truth is that communists are responsible for millions upon tens of millions of deaths. Their leader is Gabby Fechner Engel. I'm not sure if she's related to Engels or if she just chose to use a name that is a variation of his. Notice how she and her chosen comrades do not wear masks, yet all of the other people in attendance are wearing masks. Here's a quote from one of her anti-white speeches concerning the German Wehrmacht. They committed unbelievable crimes. They destroyed 70,000 towns and villages on Soviet soil. They started pogroms against Jews. They hanged political commissars of the Red Army. They raped women. We all know there was stiff punishment for any German soldier that went around raping women. Gabby does not need to show any proof that this happened, because her and her ilk currently control the narrative. Wikipedia also states the MLPD advocates for the establishment of a dictatorship of the proletariat, overthrowing current capitalist relations of production and replacing them with a new social order of socialist orientation. It sees this as a transitional stage to the creation of a classless communist society. In doing so, it refers to the theory and practice of Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Vladimir Lenin, Joseph Stalin, and Mao Zedong. It rejects the terms Stalinist and Maoism as anti-communist fighting terms that divides the Marxist-Leninist movement. While criticizing particular aspects of the political works of Stalin and Mao, MLPD openly defends those works, standing in contrast to the most left-wing groups in Germany. This party also pretends to care about Palestinians and the apartheid state. They are called anti-Israel. Deutsche Bank and the Postbank have closed all of its bank accounts in Germany. Controlled opposition at its finest. Oh, you don't like Jews killing Palestinians? Come join the anti-white commies. Oh, you don't like commies? Come join the National Bolsheviks. They care about nationalism and stuff. There's also a Lenin statue in Seattle, which was home of Chaz / Chop. This statue, I believe, is about 16 feet tall. It's huge. Maybe even more. And there is a Masonic lodge right behind the statue. It's pretty clear what's going on when you realize that we are allowed to wave communist flags and erect statues of communist leaders who are responsible for so much carnage, yet any statue of a white person deemed a colonist must go. The reason for this is because they plan to spread this ideology to the whole world. It's not coming. We are in the middle of it. Things will get drastically worse if people don't wake up to what's going on. Imagine the number below multiplied many times over. So just had the highest death tolls in history. World War I, 38 million. World War II, 50 to 80 million. And then communism, 100 to 150 million. That's actually probably a conservative estimate there. All right, so let's take a listen to what one of the co-founders of the Black Lives Matter movement said when she was being interviewed by the commies at the Real News Network.
I also think that it might, I think of a lot of things. The first thing I think is that we actually do have an ideological frame. Myself and Alicia in particular are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists. We are super versed on sort of ideological theories. And I think that what we really try to do is build a movement that could be utilized by many, many Black folk. We are trained Marxists. We
are trained Marxists. Who trained you? Who trained you in Marxism? Would it be the same people, the same tribe that trained MLK, the commie? Would it be the same tribe that trained Nelson Mandela, that terrorist in South Africa? Would that be the same tribe? Yes, they've been doing this time and time again. Trained Marxists. Yeah, the leaders of BLM are trained Marxists. Now, when BLM had their big thing going, over 4 years ago, with Ferguson and all that, before they went dormant for a while, they had a bunch of people out with banners that had, Black Lives Matter, and then RevCom.us. A lot of people probably didn't even bother to go check out what RevCom.us is, but it's Revolutionary Communists here in the U.S. Yeah, the voice of the Revolutionary Communist Party USA. And it's led by this guy, Bob Avakian, who was part of the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, back in the day. And he's been leading the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party, since 1979. And he has an ideology, a theoretical framework that's rooted in Maoism, called the New Synthesis, or the New Communism. Coming out of the New Left, Avakian has written several books over four decades, including an autobiography. Okay, so Avakian says that he is coming out of the New Left, okay? What did Richard Spencer say? That the alt-right is the New Left? And just look at how many alt-right figures now are National Bolsheviks. They are controlling both sides, people. Yep, with Comrade Keith Woods and Eric Stryker and all the other Nazbols out there, formerly Matt Heimbach, and all the people who love Alexander Dugin. Yeah, they are just at the flip side to these anti-white revolutionary communists. The National Bolsheviks and the Revolutionary Communists. You gotta pick a side, guys. No, you absolutely do not. So let's actually listen to a statement from this Bob Avakian that he released on June 5th of this year, so in the wake of a lot of these racial protests, just to see where their minds are at right now and how the Revolutionary Communists are really seeking to win over basically a big black army. All right.
This is Bob Avakian speaking. To all those who have risen up so powerfully and are demonstrating to say no more after the murder of George Floyd and all the other cold-blooded murders by police, to all those who have drawn inspiration from this righteous uprising, to all those who have had the blinders forced from their eyes and have been provoked to think anew about what kind of country it is that we live in. This has raised the biggest questions about what is needed for people everywhere to live fully as human beings. An end to institutionalized racism and murder by police, nothing less. An end to any way people anywhere are used, abused, and brutalized, nothing less. We need a world without white supremacy and male supremacy. A world where no one is regarded as alien. A world without war, where people from all over the globe, with a beautiful flowering of diversity, act together for the common good and are truly caretakers of the earth. This is not just a dream. The possibility for this is being powerfully demonstrated in this uprising of the people, of all different races and genders, from all parts of the world, refusing to remain silent or stay passive while all this oppression and brutality goes on. To make all this real, we need revolution, nothing less. A strategic plan for how to make this revolution, and a sweeping vision and concrete blueprint for a radically different and much better world, where all this can become possible, can be found in the work I have done, including the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. You can learn more about this revolution and become part of making it a reality by going to revcom.us and joining with the RevComs. We do not need to live in this world where so much of humanity suffers so unnecessarily under this system of capitalism imperialism that cannot exist without exploiting and degrading people, suffocating their humanity, and killing them without mercy. We can do much better. Don't listen to talk about how it can never happen. Look around you. What seemed impossible yesterday is happening right now. Revolution. Why should we settle for anything less?
Okay, so he's right. Look around you. Revolution is happening everywhere, and just like with the bloody Bolshevik Revolution that was led by Jews, it's being financed by the capitalist Jews. Isn't that just crazy that these capitalist Wall Street Jews would go and fund the Bolshevik Revolution, and same thing happening today. Isn't it just crazy that all these big multinational corporations, all these big politicians and the big fat cats with their big bankrolls would be sending all of this money, what is it, over a billion and a half now, to Black Lives Matter type organizations, all these different funds that have been set up in order to initiate and continue the communist revolution in the United States. Why would the capitalists want to have a communist revolution in the United States? Because it's two sides of the same shekel. They work with each other to achieve their goals. It's the synthesis, antithesis, and thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis of the problem, reaction, solution, which is being employed in the Hegelian dialectic, you know, which is the Jewish version of the Hegelian dialectic. So, with that in mind, let's also consider that a lot of these people today who are fighting for the communist revolution in the United States are not necessarily Marxist-Leninists, or at least they don't know that is what they are, but they are pretty much following what Herbert Marcuse and the Frankfurt School laid out. And one of the things that they really were working on was something that would be titled Liberating Tolerance. So it was a policy of unequal treatment that would protect radicalism on the left against that on the right. And this Marcuse laid this out in 1965. Liberating tolerance, then, would mean intolerance against movements from the right and toleration of movements from the left. That's what we're seeing today, aren't we? I'm not saying that the right is correct, that the right is actually on our side, but you have any kind of resistance from somebody on the right saying, hey, this is not good, we shouldn't be, you know, burning down cities, and then, oh my god, the whole mob comes after them, censor them, muzzle them. You know, mask wasn't enough, just muzzle their speech in other ways too. Get them booted offline, get them fired, whatever the case may be. This is called liberating tolerance. Marcuse dismissed the idea of individual liberty protected by law in favor of a Marxist society favoring ostensibly oppressed groups at the expense of everybody else. Such a society, Marcuse wrote, would demand the withdrawal of toleration of speech and assembly from groups and movements. That was written by Joseph D. Hippolyto. Marcuse even justified violence. There is a natural right of resistance for oppressed and overpowered minorities to use extra legal means if the legal ones have proved to be inadequate. That's what we're seeing today, right? So these guys are cultural Marxists. They might not have ever read any of Karl Marx's, you know, that Jew's original works. They might not have really been inspired by the Bolsheviks. But what they are doing is they're using the playbook of the cultural Marxists. And I want to now turn to a historical example of a Marxist-Leninist and what he did to his country in what was known as Year Zero, when the revolution really took hold. And I am talking about Pol Pot, who was a Marxist-Leninist. He was a student of Mao, and he was the general secretary of the Communist Party of Kampuchea from 1963 to 1981. And Kampuchea is what they were calling Cambodia. And I'm not sure if I'm saying Kampuchea correctly, but I've never really heard somebody talk about it, so I don't know how to say it correctly. And to be honest, guys, I didn't really get any of this history in all of my schooling. Nobody really taught me about this. Of course, I'd heard about Pol Pot. I had heard about the Khmer Rouge. I maybe had heard a few times about Year Zero, but it's only recently that people have really been bringing up Year Zero in relation to what's going on today, which caused me to look into this a bit more. But this is just hidden from the history classes of people in the United States. We don't know the horrors of what happened in the communist countries in the 20th century. That's to be completely hidden. Instead, we have to have whole classes taught about the Holocaust. So, wow, this is really strange. Okay, here. Year Zero. I'm looking just at Wikipedia here for a brief synopsis of Year Zero. The term Year Zero applied to the takeover of Cambodia in April 1975 by the Khmer Rouge in an analogy to the year one of the French Revolutionary calendar. And so with the French Revolution, it was the Masons, it was Jewish supremacists who were instigating this violence, and that was in itself also anti-white, anti-Aryan. They went after anybody who was blonde and tried to behead them, simply because blonde hair was a symbol of the aristocracy. Isn't that something? You're not taught about that, are you? During the French Revolution, after the abolition of the French monarchy, that was in 1792, the National Convention instituted a new calendar and declared that date to be the beginning of Year One. The Khmer Rouge's takeover of Phnom Penh was rapidly followed by a series of drastic revolutionary deindustrialization policies, which resulted in a death toll which vastly exceeded the death toll which resulted from the French Reign of Terror. Some estimates put it at about a quarter of the country of Cambodia, the quarter of the population, were killed in the communist revolution in Cambodia. concept. The idea behind Year Zero is that all culture and traditions within a society must be completely destroyed or discarded, and a new revolutionary culture must replace it, starting from scratch. Is that not what we're seeing with all these statues being torn down? With now calls for the national anthem to be changed. I just talked about that in my last show, and I saw it on the TV when I was at the gym. Yep, calls for the national anthem to be changed because that guy, Francis Scott Key, he was a racist white supremacist. He had slaves. You got to get rid of his statue. That's already been done, right? Now you got to just start from scratch, get Beyonce and Jay-Z to come up with a new national anthem. All of the history of a nation or people before Year Zero is largely deemed irrelevant because it will ideally be purged and replaced from the ground up. In democratic Kampuchea, so-called new people, intellectuals and members of the old governments, were especially singled out and executed during the purges accompanying Year Zero. Any time that the communists take over, that the bloody Bolsheviks have their reign of terror, they target intellectuals. They target anybody deemed to be a threat, anybody within the military hierarchy who could potentially lead a movement against them. They do not like intelligence outside of their own party. They want only the dumb slaves to exist so as to work for their regime. It's just crazy that this is what is happening now, today. All right, let's dig a little bit deeper and take a look at a history.com article on the Khmer Rouge. Of course, this is just still mainstream history. One that we're relatively unfamiliar with, though. The Khmer Rouge was a brutal regime that ruled Cambodia under the leadership of Marxist dictator Pol Pot from 1975 to 1979. Pol Pot's attempts to create a Cambodian master race, I'd like to see a citation on that. You know, I didn't know that this guy thought of his people as, you know, the master race. Through social engineering, ultimately led to the deaths of more than 2 million people in the Southeast Asian country. Some estimates put it upwards of 3 million people. Those killed were either executed as enemies of the regime or died from starvation, disease, or overwork. Historically, this period, as shown in the film The Killing Fields, has come to be known as the Cambodian Genocide. Pol Pot. Although Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge didn't come to power until the mid-1970s, the roots of their takeover can be traced to the 1960s, when a communist insurgency first became active in Cambodia, which was then ruled by a monarch. Throughout the 1960s, the Khmer Rouge operated as the armed wing of the Communist Party of Kampuchea, the name the party used for Cambodia. Operating primarily in remote jungle and mountain areas in the northeast of the country, near its border with Vietnam, which at the time was embroiled in its own civil war, the Khmer Rouge did not have popular support across Cambodia, particularly in the cities, including the capital, Phnom Penh. However, oh, by the way, Phnom Penh now has a Chabad house. However, after 1970, military coup led to the ouster of Cambodia's ruling monarch, Prince Norodom Sihanouk, the Khmer Rouge decided to join forces with the deposed leader and form a political coalition. As the monarch had been popular among city-dwelling Cambodians, the Khmer Rouge began to glean more and more support. For the next 5 years, a civil war between the right-leaning military, which had led the coup, and those supporting the alliance of Prince Norodom and the Khmer Rouge raged in Cambodia. Eventually, the Khmer Rouge side seized the advantage in the conflict after gaining control of increasing amounts of territory in the Cambodian countryside. In 1975, the Khmer Rouge fighters invaded Phnom Penh and took over the city. With the capital in its grasp, the Khmer Rouge had won the civil war and thus ruled the country. Notably, the Khmer Rouge opted not to restore power to Prince Norodom, could have seen that one coming, but instead handed power to the leader of the Khmer Rouge, Pol Pot. Prince Norodom was forced to live in exile. As a leader of the Khmer Rouge during its days as an insurgent movement, Pol Pot came to admire the tribes in Cambodia's rural northeast. These tribes were self-sufficient and lived on the goods they produced through subsistence farming. The tribes, he felt, were like communes in that they worked together, shared in the spoils of their labor, and were untainted by the evils of money, wealth, and religion, the latter being the Buddhism common in Cambodia's cities. Once installed as the country's leader by the Khmer Rouge, Pol Pot and the forces loyal to him quickly set about remaking Cambodia, which they had renamed Kampuchea, in the model of these rural tribes, with the hopes of creating a communist-style agricultural utopia. Declaring 1975 year zero in the country, Pol Pot isolated Kampuchea from the global community. He resettled hundreds of thousands of the country's city dwellers in rural farming communes and abolished the country's currency. He also outlawed the ownership of private property and the practice of religion in the new state nation. Workers on the farm collectives established by Pol Pot soon began suffering from the effects of overwork and lack of food. Hundreds of thousands died from disease, starvation, or damage to their bodies sustained during backbreaking work or abuse from the ruthless Khmer Rouge guards overseeing the camps. Pol Pot's regime also executed thousands of people it had deemed as enemies of the state. Those seen as intellectuals or potential leaders of a revolutionary movement were also executed. Legend has it, some were executed for merely appearing to be intellectuals by wearing glasses or being able to speak a foreign language. As part of this effort, hundreds of thousands of the educated middle-class Cambodians were tortured and executed in special centers established in the cities, the most infamous of which was Tuol Sleng Jail in Phnom Penh, where nearly 17,000 men, women, and children were imprisoned during the regime's 4 years in power. During what became known as the Cambodian Genocide, an estimated 1.7 to 2.2 million Cambodians died during Pol Pot's time in charge of the country. The Vietnamese army invaded Cambodia in 1979 and removed Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge from power after a series of violent battles on the border between the two countries. Pol Pot had sought to extend his influence into the newly unified Vietnam, but his forces were quickly rebuffed. After the invasion, Pol Pot and his Khmer Rouge fighters quickly retreated to remote areas of the country. However, they remained active as an insurgency, albeit with declining influence. Vietnam retained control in the country, with a military presence for much of the 1980s, over the objections of the United States. Over the decades since the fall of the Khmer Rouge, Cambodia has gradually reestablished ties with the world community, although the country still faces problems, including widespread poverty and illiteracy. Prince Norodom returned to govern Cambodia in 1993, although he now rules under a constitutional monarchy. Pol Pot himself lived in the rural northeast of the country until 1997, when he was tried by the Khmer Rouge for his crimes against the state. The trial was seen as being mostly for show, however, and the former dictator died while under house arrest in his jungle home. The stories of the suffering of the Cambodian people at the hands of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge have garnered worldwide attention in the years since their rise and fall, including through a fictional account of the atrocities in the 1984 movie The Killing Fields. So one of the reasons people really knew about what was taking place in Cambodia and Year Zero is because of this documentary filmmaker named John Pilger. So let's take a look. I've not watched this documentary yet, Year Zero, The Silent Death of Cambodia, but it is freely available, and you can watch it on Vimeo. It's up on johnpilger.com as well. John Pilger's shocking 1979 documentary, Year Zero, The Silent Death of Cambodia, alerted the world to the horrors wrought by Pol Pot and his Khmer Rouge. The film was originally broadcast on commercial television in Britain and Australia without advertising, which was unprecedented. The British Film Institute lists Year Zero as one of the 10 most important documentaries of the 20th century. Pilger reveals that as many as 2 million people out of a population of 7 million were killed or starved by Pol Pot's medievalists. The genocide of Pol Pot, he says, was begun by Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. The film is replete with evidence that the U.S. bombing of Cambodia from 1969 to 1973 caused such turmoil that the rise of the Khmer Rouge to power in 1975 was made inevitable. In his introduction, Pilger says to the camera, "The new rulers of Cambodia called 1975 Year Zero, the dawn of an age in which there would be no families, no sentiment, no expressions of love or grief, no medicines, no hospitals, no schools, no books, no learning, no holidays, no music, no song, no post, no money, only work and death. For me, coming here has been like stumbling into something I could never imagine, and what follows is the first complete film report by Westerners from the ashes of a gentle land. With director David Monroe, camera operator Jerry Pinchas, sound recordist Stephen Phillips, and photographer Eric Piper, Pilger arrived in Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh, as if in the wake of a nuclear war that spared only the buildings. Nothing had prepared us, he said. There was no power, no drinking water, no shops, no services of any kind. At the railway station, trains stood empty at various stages of interrupted departure. Personal belongings and pieces of clothing fluttered on the platforms as they fluttered on the mass graves beyond. I had no sense of even the remains of a population. The few human shapes I glimpsed seemed incoherent and, on catching sight of me, would flit into a doorway. A child ran into a wardrobe living on its side, which was his or her refuge. In a crumbling SO filling station, an old woman and three emaciated infants squatted around a pot containing a mixture of roots and leaves, which bubbled over a fire fueled with paper money. Such grotesque irony. People in need of everything had money to burn. At Tuol Sleng Extermination Center, where men, women, and children were tortured and killed, black and white photographs of the victims stare out of the screen. Outside, deserted streets are interrupted by the lone figure of an infant, his parents almost certainly dead or missing, weaving his way down the middle of the road. Everyone Pilger meets has lost at least six family members. Perhaps the most shocking pictures are those of emaciated children fighting for their lives, most of them dying from starvation or nutrition-related illnesses that are preventable and curable in the West. Jerry Pinchas filmed the children through his own tears. Pilger's spontaneous, vivid reporting of the power of politics that caused such suffering is a model of anger suppressed. He describes how, as a means of punishing the Vietnamese, whose army had liberated Cambodia, having just liberated its own country from the Americans, the United States and its allies declared a blockade on stricken Cambodia. So after Vietnam got rid of Pol Pot, the United States blockaded Cambodia. UNICEF's representative, Jacques Beaumont, says in one of the very poor barracks with practically nothing, there was already 54 children dying. One of them was sitting in the corner of the room with swollen legs because he was starving. He did not have the strength to look at me or to anybody. He was just waiting to die. 10 days later, four of these children were dead, and I will always remember that saying. I did not do anything for these children because we had nothing. The International Red Cross representative, Francois Bougnon, took Pilger aside and asked him if he could contact someone in the Australian government who can arrange for an aircraft to fly in a truck, food, and drugs to save thousands of lives while the politics are being ironed out. Pilger later describes his failed attempt to get a response from the Australian ambassador in Bangkok. Near the end of the film, he refers to a starving boy whose screams can be heard rising and falling in agony. Of course, he says directly to the camera, if you're in Geneva or New York or London, you can't hear the screams of this little boy. Year Zero's broadcast in Britain had a phenomenal public response. 40 sacks of post arrived at the ATV studios in Birmingham with £1 million in the first few days. This is for Cambodia, wrote an anonymous Bristol bus driver, enclosing his week's wage. An elderly woman sent her pension for 2 months. A single parent sent her savings of £50. Oh, those racist British people, right? Sending all their money to Cambodia after just watching a documentary. Do you think the immigrants in the invaders in Britain were sending their money over to Cambodia? White people are just so altruistic, to be honest. Screened in 50 countries and seen by 150 million viewers, Year Zero was credited with raising more than $45 million in unsolicited aid for Cambodia, which helped rescue normal life. It restored a clean water supply in Phnom Penh, stocked hospitals and schools, supported orphanages, and reopened a desperately needed clothing factory, allowing people to discard the black uniforms of the Khmer Rouge that the Khmer Rouge had forced them to wear. Year Zero won many awards, including the Broadcasting Press Guild's Best Documentary and the International Critics Prize at the Monte Carlo International Television Festival. Pilger himself won the 1980 United Nations Media Peace Prize for having done so much to ease the suffering of the Cambodian people. Oh, yeah. The United Nations is always just so interested in easing suffering, right? Pilger made a total of 5 documentaries on Cambodia with a close friend, David Monroe. Their later films reported on the American and British government's backdoor support for the exiled Khmer Rouge. In 2008, the former SAS soldier Chris Ryan, then a best-selling author, lamented in a newspaper interview that when John Pilger, the foreign correspondent, discovered we were training the Khmer Rouge in the Far East, we were sent home. David Monroe died in 1999. So, yeah, they had discovered that the United States was training the Khmer Rouge in the Far East after they had been exiled. And that's when the documentary filmmakers had to be given the boot. All right, guys. So now that you just have a little bit of that history in mind of what happened in Cambodia when revolutionary communists took control, I want you to realize just how grave the situation is here in the United States today, since revolutionary communists want to have their own year zero here. Don't think it can't happen. If we let our guard down, if we keep our guard down, rather, this is going to be an inevitability. Big, powerful people with lots and lots of money, big organizations, are trying to ensure that this happens. It is up to us, and no one else, because no one else is going to come in and save us, to ensure that year zero does not come to fruition here in the United States. It's already on its way, but it can be stopped in its tracks. People, it is a very dire situation. I know it can be depressing, but I want to let you know that as long as we are still living, breathing, and struggling, we will do everything in our power to ensure that we have a future, to ensure that our children and our grandchildren have a future. We cannot let these red revolutionaries win. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'll be back with you again soon. Take care.
Child, don't worry, child, we will.